Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Live from the green space today. And as some of you know, when we're in the green space, you can watch the Brian Lehrer Show as well as listen to it because we stream live video from here. You can go to WNYC.org. It should be on the homepage, or you can go to WNYC.org/the green space if you want to watch the Brian Lehrer Show today. And of course, we have to start with the contrasting audio clips of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen yesterday afternoon and the audio obtained by ProPublica inside one of the child separation centers near the Mexican border. If you haven't heard the ProPublica sound yet, brace yourselves because this is really hard to take. And if you understand Spanish, the words of the border control agent in this clip make it even harder. We'll translate afterwards. We've only pulled 35 seconds of a 7-minute audio tape of 10 children separated from their parents or guardians and clearly distraught.
Bueno, aquí tenemos una orquesta.
The words on the tape from the Border Patrol agent as translated by ProPublica were, well, we have an orchestra here, right? So that indicates there were multiple children crying. And then he makes a joke. What we're missing is a conductor. Very funny. And then an unidentified man's voice saying, don't cry. So at a press briefing yesterday, Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen had not yet heard that tape, nor had she seen the NBC News videos of children in a cage, but she said the press is focusing on the wrong things.
Since 2013, the United States has admitted more than 500,000 illegal immigrant minors and family units from Central America, most of whom today are at large in the United States. At the same time, large criminal organizations such as MS-13 have violated our borders and gained a deadly foothold within the United States.
So that was consistent with what President Trump was saying earlier yesterday, what historian John Meacham on Morning Joe this morning called weaponizing immigration, portraying Mexican migrants not as families seeking a better life, but as enemy combatants.
You see about child separation, you see what's going on there. But just remember, a country without borders is not a country at all. We need borders. We need security. We need safety. We have to take care of our people. You take a look at the death and destruction that's been caused by people coming into this country without going through a process.
So let's start there with our first guest today, Catherine Rampell, business and economics correspondent for The Washington Post. Hi, Catherine. Welcome back to WNYC and welcome to the Green Space.
Good to be here.
And listeners, I see some of you are calling in already. So on any side of that issue or anything else you might want to talk about with Catherine Rampell, and we're definitely going to go to tariffs, which is a big story today. There are big shocks on stock markets around the world this morning in response to the U.S. and China going back and forth and the way they've done the last few days. So we'll get to that and some other things. And it's all fair game on the phones. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, since there seems to be some pent-up demand to talk about the audio that we've played so far and that whole story. More calls coming in than usual before we even give out the number. Just want everybody else to have it. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. 9-2. And Catherine, my God, that crying children tape. Has the administration responded to it directly, as far as you know?
Not that I've seen. It's possible I've missed something, but I thought it was very telling that Secretary Nielsen yesterday said she had not heard the audio, even though it had been everywhere for a while at that point. I think the press conference was at 5. And beyond that, she also claimed that she had not seen photos released by CBP, Customs and Border Patrol, I believe is the full name, which is under her purview. CBP is in the Department of Homeland Security, of which she is the secretary. She claimed she had not seen the photos of children in cages, which were very upsetting, I think, for a lot of people. One of the journalists who was at that press conference asked her, well, why haven't we seen photos of the girls? Why haven't we seen photos of the toddlers and babies who have been taken from their parents? And she didn't really have an answer. So I don't know. The whole thing is stomach churning, and this administration can't seem to keep its story straight.
And I guess what the audio tape reveals is that if people are saying, don't worry, these children are being well taken care of, this is not traumatic, we're protecting them, then this reveals something different that's just emotionally, and it's audio tape, so it's not on display for people to hear, but it's certainly, to see, but it's certainly on display for people to hear. And then the Border Patrol agent says, sounds like an orchestra here.
Yeah. And there have been lots of other stories that may not have the same sort of salience because we don't have audio or video, but there have been other stories that have come from advocates who have visited with children or who have visited these detention centers saying that the people who work at these various kinds of facilities are not allowed to pick up or comfort very young children who are crying out for their parents, children who are in diapers. They can't be comforted. They can't be picked up. They've been ripped from their parents. I mean, the whole thing is incredibly upsetting. And I think part of the reason why the administration keeps sort of obfuscating about what's going on is that it's very difficult to defend it on the merits. So that's why you have conflicting explanations. You have John Kelly having said it was a deterrent, Sessions saying it's biblical, you have Nielsen saying it's not actually a real policy, Trump saying it's a democratic law, which makes no sense. There are all of these conflicting explanations because, again, it's very hard to defend what we're doing on the merits.
So let me actually play a longer excerpt of Homeland Security Secretary Nielsen at her briefing yesterday explaining and defending, as she describes it, when they separate parents and children, and get your reaction, including fact-checking, if any.
We have a long existing policy multiple administrations have followed that outline when we may take action to protect children. We will separate those who claim to be a parent and child if we cannot determine a familiar or custodial relationship exists. For example, if there's no documentation to confirm the clean relationship between an adult and a child. We do so if the parent is a national security, public, or safety risk, including when there are criminal charges at issue, and it may not be appropriate to maintain the family in detention together. We also separate a parent and child if the adult is suspected of human trafficking. There have been cases where minors have been used and trafficked by unrelated adults in an effort to avoid detention. And I'd stop here to say in the last 5 months, we have a 314% increase in adults and children arriving at the border fraudulently claiming to be a family unit. This is obviously of concern. And separation can occur when the parent is charged with human smuggling. Under those circumstances, we would detain the parent in an appropriate secure detention facility separate from the child. What has changed is that we no longer exempt entire classes of people who break the law.
So that's very rational sounding, but what a disconnect from the audio of the kids, which again, in fairness, she hadn't heard when she spoke, but you almost suggested a minute ago that she willfully hadn't heard it because it was everywhere.
I don't know what her motivation was. Maybe she was in meetings all day, but it's her responsibility to know what's going on at these facilities. And I would also point out in that explanation that she gave, she said that if you come at a port of entry and you present yourself for asylum, you won't be separated. That is demonstrably false. If you look at the ACLU legal filings. They have filed for a class action suit representing the families that have been separated at the border seeking asylum. They have multiple clients, named clients, who have been separated at ports of entry, so that meaning, just to explain the technicalities, that they did not unlawfully cross into our country. They got up to the border. They said, hi, I'd like to apply for asylum. I'm here with my kid. They did not actually commit the misdemeanor of crossing the border unlawfully, and they were still separated from their biological children. And were separated for months. So it's just not true that they're only separating families once they've crossed the border, if they broke a law, et cetera, if you present yourself at a port of entry. Beyond that, there have been lots of stories about how the ports of entry have been blocked off recently, or there are multiple days-long waits once you get there, once you get to the bridge or some other port of entry, and you say, hey, I'd like to apply for asylum. People are waiting days in the hot sun without food or water, again, with toddlers sometimes, with babies or other children of various ages. And so it's easy enough to tell them you'll be exempted from this horrible policy if you go to these places, except A, they're not following their own policy, and B, they're making it very difficult, even if they did follow their own policy, to apply in exactly the manner that the administration has suggested.
I want to take a phone call from a listener. We're going to go to Ahmad in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, calling in on line 9. Ahmad, you're on WNYC. Hello from New York.
Good morning, Brian. Good morning to your guests. First of all, I'm an immigrant. I lived in a country quite long enough, about 12 or 13 years. And I've been following the news for last 2 days or so about ripping the children from their parents. And that's not the American we knew. That's not the leader of the free world. The leader of the free world opened their arms for people, welcomed them, and just this thing is really disappointing. It's humiliating. It's kind of disturbing to me as the father of two children. Imagine if I'm not living here legally. That's what happened to me. So, like I was telling your screeners, this reminded me of the ship that's been turned back coming.
I think he used one of the seven words you're not allowed to say on radio or television. So listeners out there, though people could hear it in the green space, that's why we electronically jumped out of that call. But we understand what Ahmad was saying to the thrust of his point. So let's go to another caller on line 6, Quincy in White Plains. Quincy, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Hi, thank you. I just was calling to say, I was like, I'm really hurt by that audio. I can't lie, because I'm a father of a 3-year-old little girl, and I don't know what I would do if we were in this situation that these families are in, being separated and, just really doing what they're doing out of desperation. And I also wanted to say that, cause I was actually, I didn't vote. I'm not going to lie. I didn't vote for Trump in the last election, but, I was starting to warm up to him prior to this a little bit because, the economy is doing well. And I know, I'm kind of neutral in terms of, Democrat, Republican, but mm-hmm. I know the liberal media and the more conservative media, they take shots at each other and stuff. But this really turned, I there's a lot of friends of mine who were starting to warm up to him too. They weren't necessarily the supporters, but again, because the economy and other things, but this totally kills it, and this totally like turns people, just against them. It's just so ugly. It really is. But on the flip side of that coin also is that, the people who are coming here out of desperation, they also need to understand they're dealing with a really, really hardcore administration. And they got to understand before they leave their countries that, look, there's consequences to bringing your kids across those deserts or across those rivers, across those mountains and stuff. you know, with coyotes and all types of, you know, kind of seemingly unsavory characters and stuff like that. So I think on both sides, you know, people, there needs to be more truth spoken,
Quincy,
especially in the liberal media. You know what I mean? Because, you know, I mean, this is a danger. This is dangerous stuff that these, you know, I know they're coming out of desperation, but I mean, I mean, you know, again, I can't really say what I would do. I don't know what I would do, but Jesus, you're putting your kids through, you're putting your kids through a lot, you know, and people just have to understand this administration is hardcore.
Quincy, thank you so much for your call. Please call us again. Wow, Catherine, I mean, Jeff Sessions has said as much that this is a policy of deterrence. The point is for the word to spread so that the kinds of people Quincy was referring to at the end of the call, the people who may be in desperate situations in Central American countries, know what the risks are, not only from the coyotes and other unsavory characters as he identified them, but also that this kind of separation or just not being allowed entry is going to happen.
Yes, I think that is clearly an explicit part of this policy, although Secretary Nielsen claimed otherwise yesterday. A few hours later, Jeff Sessions went on TV on Fox News and said, yes, this is a deterrent. This is supposed to be, I mean, he didn't use these exact words, but this is supposed to be so painful, essentially, that people won't come here, no matter how desperate their situation is, no matter whether they're being politically prosecuted or hunted down by gangs or their children have been recruited into gangs, et cetera.
And then to go back to Quincy's call, as he said, a hardcore administration, I guess the moral question becomes, okay, a country has a right to have borders and to defend its borders and to not let people just flow across the border except as determined by U.S. law. But what is the line morally that a country shouldn't cross in order to send that deterrent message? And I think that's really the point that people are debating right now. The Trump, you know, immigration policies in general are being hotly debated and have been for a year and a half, 2 years. It was June of 2015 that he started his campaign, right? So we are 3 years since he came down the steps of Trump Tower and started his presidential campaign by saying Mexico isn't sending their best, they're rapists, they're drug dealers. I assume some are nice people. Mm-hmm. So 3 years of this. But on the larger immigration policies, the debate goes on. On this, as a deterrent, there's a new moral question.
Well, look, there are a few things to unpack here. One is that the numbers of illegal immigrants have been falling in the last, I don't know, basically since the Great Recession. They have been falling.
But
so,
let me jump in on that. Because, since the Great Recession, I see you're talking about that long a period of time, 10 years. Mm-hmm. But the number of illegal crossings last year was apparently down even from what it had been the year before. And then this year, it's back up. And that's one of the reasons they're doing this. And apparently, Trump was really angry at Homeland Security Secretary Nielsen for allowing that to happen because the border is under her purview.
Yes, but even so, we need to remember that it's not like Trump likes to conflate all sorts of immigrants. You know, everybody's a member of MS-13 in his mind, it seems. But it's not just illegal immigrants that they're going after. We're talking about legal immigrants as well. And this administration and members of Congress, for that matter, as well, have been trying their darndest to reduce numbers of legal immigrants, too. And the people who are applying for asylum, again, many of them are trying to come here legally. So this idea that we're facing this overwhelming flow of illegal immigrants and they're just taking over our country, I think is incredibly misguided and misleading. And what you have going on is the administration, again, trying to conflate all these various groups, make people feel like they're in danger. As to the question of what is our moral obligation, I don't think anybody is arguing for open borders, despite what Secretary Nielsen said yesterday. She said, you know, the only alternative to separating families is open borders. That's what the other side says. That's just not true. There are ways to have a secure border, to process people who are applying for asylum much more quickly than we currently do. I think there's something like a backlog of like 60,000 people, I don't know what the number is, who are currently applying for asylum. So we could devote more resources to that. There are plenty of ways to, enforce the law without separating babies from their parents. You could keep families together in detention. This is what previous administrations had done and that what this administration has decided not to do, even after parents have been released in many cases from jail. So let's say you have crossed the border unlawfully, and some people obviously do, and then try to apply for asylum. The parents go to jail. They're charged with a misdemeanor. Let's say they're convicted. There have been lots of cases, including, again, in this ACLU lawsuit, where the parents are released from jail and the kids have been sent off to some center thousands of miles away and they can't get them back. So there are a lot of ways that we could improve upon this system that do not constitute creating open borders that would fulfill the law. And, you know, we can argue about where the line is in terms of our moral obligations to people who are in desperate situations. But I think it is clearly immoral to be taking babies that are breastfeeding from their mothers.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, live in the green space today. Our first guest, Washington Post columnist Catherine Rampell. And let's take a call on line 9 from Doc in Queens. Doc, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you for having me. Yes, I was calling to throw a scenario to the parents being taken, children being taken away from their parents, and that something came into my mind, a situation like when browns and blacks are being shut down in the street, that's being taken away from their children. To me, that's a similar scenario.
Doc, thank you very much. I will point out, as I do, when callers tell the screeners one thing and go on the air and say something else, that he told our screeners he's a conservative Republican and supports the policy.
I will point out, by the way, one of our earlier callers had said that he was disenchanted with Trump, that he had sort of been won over and then changed his mind because of this family separations policy. I'm not sure how representative he is. And well, maybe if he considers himself an independent, but there were two polls that came out yesterday that found that a majority of Republicans are in support of this policy.
Right. Well, in fact, that was one of the other things I was going to bring up. 66% in the new Quinnipiac poll disapprove of the separation policy, including 70% of women. But 55% of Republicans do approve. And Trump's overall approval rating in the new Gallup poll has risen to the highest level of his presidency, 45%. Which, by the way, and for those who see this president as such an outlier, this may be a shock, is right in line with other presidents' approval ratings at this point in their terms. So just after the 500-day mark, Barack Obama also 45%, Bill Clinton 44%. And analysts say this is possibly a North Korea summit bump right now, and the child separation issue hasn't been factored in yet when those polls were taken the last few days. But still, the abnormal president is in the normal range.
Look, I think there are a few ways to explain this. One is the North Korea summit, which I'm not sure produced anything tangible, but I think people are maybe hopeful that there will be some progress that comes out of this. Two is that the economy is doing well. I would point out that we're seeing basically a continuation of the exact same trends we saw for like the last 9 years in terms of the unemployment rate has been falling pretty much in a straight line. GDP growth is not, you know, so anomalous today relative to the trends we've seen before, et cetera. But nonetheless, the economy has been steadily improving. And if it gets better every day, you would think that people would feel better about the economy every day. And that may be boosting Trump's poll numbers. And then beyond that, I think there's just so much news. And despite the fact that much of the news is unflattering about Trump, you know, there have been all of these scandals coming out of his administration, Scott Pruitt and others. You have the Mueller investigation turning up things that look not particularly good for Trump and those in his orbit. There's just so much to follow that I think it's hard to keep track for most people. I can barely keep track, and it's my job. So I think that to some extent he's proven a little bit resistant to all of this negative news.
And I think another possible conclusion or contributor is that the president may be abnormal, but the feelings of the people are not. It's a culture war that on some level has been going on since the 1960s, which we will talk about more with our next guests. And it's largely these days over immigration, largely over who Americans think does more harm than good. Certainly Trump's base seems to rally around him, around the Mueller investigation, as they believe the claims that it's illegitimate through various arguments and pieces of evidence. And it's about who feels included or alienated by the decisions of national leaders. It's tribal in that respect.
Yes, I think that there's to be clear, his disapproval ratings are still quite large. And I think the strong disapproval ratings are unusually high. I don't have the numbers in front of me. So even if his approval ratings are good, it's still maybe not, or it's still less than 50%, I guess. But so was the case with these other presidents.
Right, the disapproval was about 50%, which is very high. You know what? Let's take, I think, a real Republican who supports Trump. We'll try Anthony in Staten Island on line 3. Anthony, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, good morning, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. First and foremost, I'd like to say that the immigration system that we have currently in place is absolutely broken. It's been broken for decades. And I think we need to speak more about the lack of accountability on the part of our lawmakers to fix this. I can't say I agree with everything that President Trump is doing. I did vote for him. But first and foremost, I think the number one job of our lawmakers is to protect the legal citizens of the United States. And all too often, whenever we talk about immigration, we characterize it as immigration, not illegal immigration in this situation. But how much tolerance should we have? How much should it cost our taxpayers to process these folks? This is the greatest country on the face of the planet. When the colonists had issues with the way the colonies were being run, they stood up for themselves and they fought and they made changes, and that's what gave birth to this great country. So we need to, it has to be a multi-pronged approach. We have to see what's going on in these other countries, what's forcing these people to come to this country, and try to help resolve it that way. People are trying to get into this country by the hundreds of thousands. And, you know, and hearing babies cry in the background, instead of sensationalizing that, I think we need to call our lawmakers into account and really try to fix it, sit down and try to fix it.
And obviously there are a lot of opinions in Congress, and they haven't been able to come to yes on ways to fix it that satisfy varying constituencies. Anthony, is there not a point, though, at which you say, no, this is just too much. This is hard line. This makes our country something that it isn't, when Attorney General Sessions and the president are willing to go to this kind of extreme to create a deterrent?
Right. I don't want to, I really don't want to come off as, you know, an extremist, but the fact of the matter remains, and a lot of people are not going to like hearing it. These people are entering the country illegally. If you're trying to come into a country and you have to wait 3 days to be processed in the hot sun without food or water, that's really not my fault. It's not your fault. It's not the United States citizen's fault. These people are taking these risks.
And the fact that they're doing this with some people who are asking for asylum rather than just coming across illegally?
Brian, I've heard a lot of conflicting reports that there are criminals out there that are using children in order to get people across as a family unit when those people aren't even the parents of these children. It's really, the whole situation is disgusting. But to get back to your point, if you're crossing illegally, you are breaking the laws of the United States. It's a criminal act, and you're a criminal.
So what's the difference between what these folks are doing and a normally law-abiding citizen making a mistake, getting arrested, and being separated from his or her family?
Anthony, I'm going to leave it there, and I thank you for your call, and please do call us again. And Catherine, of course, that raises the moral question in another way that people will have very strong reactions to, and so many people will say, no, this is not like somebody committing an ordinary crime. This is not like robbing a bank or, you know, breaking into a home and burglarizing it or whatever, just walking across trying to get into the country to better your life. It may be illegal, but that it shouldn't be seen the same as other crime, which the administration is portraying it, as we heard in the clip from the Homeland Security Secretary.
Yeah, well, first of all, this would be a misdemeanor, and we do not have a zero tolerance policy for lots of other misdemeanors. I would also add that we were a party to the 1951 Refugee Convention, which specifically said that that countries should not prosecute refugees. This was after World War II, right? You should not prosecute refugees for unlawful presence. And that's what we're doing. So we're violating that convention. But beyond that, as I mentioned before, not all of these people are actually crossing unlawfully. They're still being separated from their kids. And I hear this analogy all the time, including from members of the administration and other people who support Trump, that that separating kids from their parents is no different from what we do for other kinds of criminals, for other kinds of crimes. But again, with other kinds of crimes, let's say that we are talking about people who crossed unlawfully, who committed a misdemeanor. With other kinds of crimes, once you're released from jail, you are reunited with your kid. Right? I mean, unless the kid is the parent is unfit or the kid isn't in an unsafe situation, et cetera. But I'm saying, absent all of those factors, you are reunited with your kid. That's not what's happening here. What's happening here is that parents are getting released from jail. Their kids have already been sent off, and they wait sometimes months to be reunited. They have to file a court case in some of these situations where they have been successfully reunited. We don't know about what's happened to the rest. The system is not set up. And I mean, I think some of this may not be deliberate, that we're trying to keep parents who are out of the criminal justice system away from their kids if they have crossed the border unlawfully. I think some of it's just like these various departments are not set up to process these thousands of families. And kids are being sent all over the country, and it's hard to track where they are. It's hard to get them back to the parents, even when the parents are out of federal custody, they're out of jail, they're out of immigration detention centers, et cetera. It's difficult to reunite them. So again, this is not comparable to how we treat other crimes.
We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back and continue here in the Green Space with Washington Post columnist Catherine Rampell. Some of you may know that she comes out of business reporting originally, and she's a business and economics as well as political columnist for the Washington Post. And we're going to turn to the other big story breaking this morning, which is stock markets in this country and around the world have been roiled this morning by the escalating trade war between the United States and China. So stay with us. We'll talk about that as we continue. Brian Lehrer Show, live from the Green Space today on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, live from the Green Space today, where you can't stop the audience members from talking to each other. Human beings, they will talk. Catherine Rampell, Washington Post columnist, has stimulated them into conversation with each other. And those of you listening on the radio should know that you can also watch us when we're live in the Green Space. We are streaming live audio on the homepage, live video, I should say, on the homepage at WNYC.org. Also on the WNYC Facebook page. That's another place that you can see live Green Space streaming video of the Brian Lehrer Show today. Let's go on to tariffs, Catherine. When we last looked, just before we went on, the Dow was down over 300 points this morning, which has wiped out the bit of gain so far for the year. So the Dow is now, maybe just a few points in negative territory for 2018. There were some really big declines, like 4% in one case, I forget which country, overnight on some of the Asian exchanges, because while most of the media coverage the last few days has been about this parent and child separation policy, there's also been an escalating trade war. Trump and China are going back and forth. With your business and economics reporting background, give us some context about what's happening.
Here's how I would characterize what's been going on. China has been a bad actor, specifically when it comes to intellectual property. So if you want to do business in China, if you're an American company or European company or Australian company or whatever, you have to partner most of the time with a Chinese firm. You have to transfer your technology to that Chinese firm. There have been other kinds of violations of intellectual property rights or sort of strong arming in terms of giving over that IP. So it's not wrong to say that China has behaved badly. What is probably wrong to do is to respond to that through massive tariffs and to start a trade war, which is essentially what we have been doing. Trump had initially announced $50 billion worth of tariffs. Last night, he announced another $200 billion worth of tariffs. Collectively, that represents about half of the imports that come in from China. And I think he believes that China will just cave and will say, okay, we're going to do whatever you say, Mr. Trump, Mr. President, and Trump is more fixated on the deficit, the trade deficit, than the IP stuff, which is the actual violation, but whatever. I think instead what we're likely to see is more retaliation from China, which could take various forms. They could raise more tariffs on American goods, which they have already announced their intention to do from the previous round of tariffs. And they've been quite strategic about what kinds of goods they have been targeting. Things like Iowa pork, ginseng that comes from, I think, Paul Ryan's district in Wisconsin or somewhere nearby. Soybeans.
He's
also
done anyway.
Right, exactly. So maybe it's not as potent right now. But soybeans, you know, lots of products that are politically sensitive. And again, we have a midterm coming up. They do not, interestingly enough. So they have a bit more leverage in that respect than we do. And there are lots of other things that they could do beyond tariffs at this point to make American companies' lives quite miserable.
So how do you see the end game, according to Trump? I know you can't read his mind, but here's this
if only
art of the deal guy who obviously has a chaos and conflict theory of negotiating, you know, when there are tough negotiating partners. We see how he dealt with Kim Jong-un from the beginning, and that seems to have gotten him somewhere. We don't know how that's going to wind up, but it's gotten him somewhere. And is he doing something like that with China, where you can see a negotiated endpoint from what he's trying to do that isn't just him misreading the situation because he doesn't understand the politics?
I think he doesn't understand the politics and he doesn't terribly well understand trade. Like I said, he's very fixated on the trade deficit, which is determined by lots of factors beyond, you know, who's winning and losing and who's making good deals, including what savings and investment levels are in various countries. I think he's misguided on a number of different levels. What he should be doing and what some members of his administration have even advocated, some of whom publicly, like Larry Kudlow, who's the head of his National Economic Council, is we should be banding together with other countries that have been similarly victimized, if you will, to use a more colorful term, by these IP policies that China has. We should be banding together with Japan and our allies in Australia and Canada and Mexico, et cetera, and saying, okay, we are going to create a coalition of the willing, and we are going to use multilateral pressure to get China back in line. And in fact, we had a way to do that. It was called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It was negotiated under President Obama, and when Trump came into office, he killed it. That would be the way to go about doing this. Of course, it's much more difficult now to switch gears to that strategy, in part because we've already alienated all of those allies through other tariffs, other trade wars that we are trying to launch at this point. So I think it'll be challenging. I don't see how these escalating tariffs on both sides, both coming from the United States and China, will get us to a situation that either country benefits from.
I want to play one more clip, and this is on another topic that the president brought up yesterday, and it's in a way consistent with what you were just talking about, even though it's about something wholly different. The president doesn't seem to like international institutions. I think there was a quote, I don't think he said it on tape. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about? It might have even been a Washington Post report. I think as he was leaving Singapore after the summit with Kim Jong-un, where he was quoted as saying he doesn't really like international rules. So whether it's trade agreements that are multinational or, you know, things that are more on the human rights side, whatever, he doesn't like the whole notion of international institutions. And maybe that somewhat plays into why he, in the middle of everything else that's going on, decided that he was going to propose this yesterday. Maybe some of you have heard it. Trump yesterday actually proposed a new branch of the United States military, the U.S. Space Force.
The essence of the American character is to explore new horizons and to tame new frontiers. But our destiny beyond the Earth is not only a matter of national identity, but a matter of national security, so important for our military, so important, and people don't talk about it. When it comes to defending America, it is not enough to merely have an American presence in space. We must have American dominance in space, so important. Very importantly, I'm hereby directing the Department of Defense and Pentagon to immediately begin the process necessary to establish a Space Force as the sixth branch of the armed forces. That's a big statement. We are going to have the Air Force and we are going to have the Space Force, separate but equal.
He got that phrase from somewhere in American history. Not exactly sure where. But this is part of his nationalist project, politically speaking, right? This is another thing that's probably supposed to land with the base. And you tweeted this morning, I saw that the defense secretary, Jim Mattis, had spoken previously against a separate United States Space Force. What do you know?
So Mattis had sent a letter to lawmakers, I think last fall, sometime last year, in which he urged them to strongly reconsider any interest in creating a separate Space Force. He said it was premature to come up with something like this, and he was too busy trying to reduce overhead in other ways and essentially suggesting this would create more overhead. So I should say I am not an expert in, you know, space politics or space defense. I don't even know how you would characterize this. But Mattis knows a lot more about this than I do. He is Trump's own cabinet member, and he had opposed this quite publicly. So I do wonder what kind of discussions, if any, went on in this White House about this proposal.
Do you know, and I'm not going to linger on this because this is neither of our expertise, but do you happen to know what the vision for a Space Force is? Is it satellites orbiting that are armed, that are staffed with human beings?
We already have satellites. I think that the details at this point are pretty vague. So
he just wants to gin up some Star Wars nationalism.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, maybe he likes the costumes or something. I don't know. Look, not to minimize this, but I don't know exactly what the strategy is here. I think you're right that this is thematically a piece with some of these other kinds of policies that we're talking about that suggest that Trump is much more interested in going it alone than having multilateral alliances of any kind. That is true in his defense policy. It's true in his trade policy and various other kinds of arenas in which we would probably benefit from teaming up with allies as we have in the past.
He did say he wants to protect the country from aliens. So.
Did he? I missed that. Well, which kind of aliens,
exactly.
I think, is the question.
I think we have one question here in the green space ready to go. Who is that? Hi.
Hi, Brian. My name's Tav. I'm from Manhattan, but I lived in California for many years, and I worked with many of the immigrant community that have been demonized recently. I worked in with many people from Mexico, Central America, and South America. And I would just like to defend them by saying that they are the most upstanding, family value, church-going people I've ever had the pleasure of knowing. Many of them I consider my very best friends. My question from a business standpoint is that President Obama was trying to get away from privatized prisons. The Republicans and Donald Trump took many contributions from that industry. Is this an attempt to fill detention centers, privately run detention centers, with business? If you suddenly make a category of crossing the border a prisonable offense, you have just handed hundreds of thousands of customers to the private prison industry.
I don't know that that's the motivation. It may be an added benefit to the extent that this industry has been supportive of the administration. I think really the motivation is xenophobia, demonizing immigrants. And also, by the way, you know, talking about a business angle to this, I wanted to mention one point that came up from a caller earlier about how it's costing us all of this money to deal with all of these illegals or whatever. You know, if you look at the actual data, people who are undocumented pay more in taxes than they consume in government services. So, again, this is sort of a tangent to what we're talking about, but I think this is a talking point that gets repeated a lot, you know, suggesting that these people who are coming here are a drain on the U.S. government, and at least at the federal level, that is not true. But I don't know the answer about private prisons.
And another comment in the green space or a question. Hi.
Hi, my name's Dawn. I'm so excited. I call you, like, weekly, and I'm so happy to be finally getting through. I'm so happy you brought that up vis-a-vis both your point and to that same caller's point. How can we as citizens deal with the quality of information? So often it strikes me that one of the most dangerous problems occurring in our democracy presently is quality of information, which is motivating the choices people are making in elections. In my own family, extended family, I deal with this problem, just unequivocally false information. And it's very difficult to talk to people about these issues when they're just wrong. And I mean, I don't want to, you know, there's that liberal elitism. I'm from LA, I've been in New York for 14 years, and I want to be sensitive, but given your expertise, do you have any advice for us as to how to maybe guide people toward more reliable sources?
I think it's a very challenging question. And to be clear, I think it's not just a problem with people on some fringe of the right. There are people in blue cities who are vastly uninformed, who get wrong information. You know, lots of information tends to go viral. And I think that's no accident that false information goes viral. The fact that it's false means that it's often more sensational. So, of course, people are going to want to share it. You know, there were these photos of children in cages that were taken under the Obama administration that got rapidly shared as evidence that Trump was treating immigrants badly. It turns out he's also putting immigrants in cages. But in any case, you know, there's a lot of misinformation on both sides. And I don't exactly know what the solution is. I wish I had a fix. I think it would be very good for democracy if I did. The best advice that I can give is try to be a savvy consumer. Try to read primary documents if you can. Make sure you pay attention to the date on various articles. This is a simple thing, but that's part of the reason why stories get shared that are taken out of context, that are not quite right. You know, there was a lot of conflation of the missing children, for the missing immigrant children, which was actually that particular report was, again, something that had happened under Obama. Doesn't mean it's not still happening now, but there was this conflation of, well, the families are being separated at the border, and then the kids are immediately being lost, relying on data from the Obama administration. So I think the best advice I have is to read a lot of different sources, try to be critical in terms of thinking through the kinds of arguments that are made, look at primary documents if you can.
Spend a little time to determine some media sources whose news you trust.
Yes.
And if you're trying to convince a relative, for example, look at the citations that those media sources cite. So if you read a Catherine Rampell column or most things in the Washington Post, they're usually going to cite where, let's say, statistics about how immigrants contribute more to the economy than they take, or whatever it might be, come from. And then you might scramble somebody's brain by presenting it to them really nicely.
Is just encouraging, like, gently source your sources. And I wonder if also for those savvy with social media to sort of counterbalance, as you said, fringy, difficult information on both sides, encouraging more solid folks that are on Twitter that are more reliable, and like pushing those and doing what we can to make people like you and others go viral, if you will.
Thank you very much. And listeners and Green Space audience, please thank Washington Post columnist Catherine Rampell.